Hey, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit, and I'm Dr. Lisa. How you guys doing today? Well, it looks like we made it. Looks like Biden's going to be running the show. We can breathe a little easier there, but the COVID's going up. So that's like people are starting to freak out. You know, there's a lot of anxiety out there. Believe you me, you're not alone in this. So there's a lot of mental health facilities that you can check in with and you can get help with. Send me a note. I've got plenty of ideas for you, okay, if you need any help. So I'm really excited about who I have on my show today. I have Tom Tenney, the station director, and his collaborator on the Wall of Lies project, Phil Bueller, who also happens to be my husband. But before we get to that, I want to just remind you that, you know, thanks for listening to Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit on Radio Free Brooklyn. We are a nonprofit organization. And you know what? Right now, it is a really tough time. And we do a lot for the community. And we bring you really good programming of all sorts. And we are a really valuable addition to everyone's life. So you should make a donation. Just check us out on Radio Free Brooklyn /donate. Go to radiofreebrooklyn.org. Look at all the stuff we got on. We've got a whole section on Wall of Lies, which is exactly what we're going to be talking about today. So anyway, I'll say hi to my guests, and then I'm just going to say hi to them because they're sitting right there, and I don't want to leave them out. And then I am going to, in my own words, I'm going to explain to you what the deal is, okay? So hi, Tom.
Hi, Lisa.
There's Tom, our station director, and Phil, who's laughing. Phil.
Hi, Lisa.
When was the last time, you know, you two spent like that whole month together? When was the last time you two actually saw each other in person?
I don't know.
You don't even remember, right?
It doesn't feel like it was very long ago. So
was it last week?
Yeah, last week sometime.
Last week.
Yeah.
Anyway, I want to explain. So for the uninitiated here, if you haven't, the Wall of Lies had press everywhere. But in case you don't know what it is, Tom was connected with somebody. And what's the guy's name at the
at the Washington Post?
Yeah.
Glenn Kessler. He's the fact checker.
The fact checker. Post. And he got in touch with you, or you got in touch with him?
No, I got in touch with him. I reached out to him in over the winter. It was in late January, early February, something like that. And I asked him if they wouldn't mind sharing the database with us. I didn't know if it was proprietary or not, but mm-hmm. I figured it couldn't hurt mm-hmm. to ask.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very happy to send. I think they sent it the same day I asked them.
Oh, actually. Really?
Yeah.
And did you have in mind, like originally it was Tom's idea. He had this in mind that he was going to be, we were all going to work together, the entire station, I don't know, 70 shows or whatever. And because the lie of all the lies, we were just going to have a whole week of different hosts reading the lies. That was your vision, Tom. So was that what you were thinking exactly when you contacted Kessler?
Yeah, well, the idea, right. So that's exactly right. So the idea initially was to do a radio marathon where we tried to read all of the, what was then at the time, 17,000 lies on the air, and see if we could do it all in 1 week if we did it 24/7, you know, every single day. And you know, and so we were going to basically do a blackout of all other programming and just do that. And that was, you know, that was sort of the initial goal. And then COVID-19 stepped in and you know, had plans of its own.
Mm-hmm. So in the meantime, I had been talking to Phil about this project that Phil had, and Phil's on the board of directors, so he also knew about it, right, from the board, Phil?
Yeah, I heard about it from you and from Tom.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So when it was getting close, it was in October or September, the beginning of September then, Anyway, Phil had this great idea. I'm going to go through this really fast and then these guys can talk about it. Phil had this great idea to make it into a entire billboard, a big wall of lies. And there were 20,000 lies. And Phil and Tom collaborated together. And what they did was they produced this post, and not a poster, just this huge banner that was 10 feet high by, it was 50 feet wide and all filled with lies. And there were different colors because Phil, the statistics expert, figured out how to put them in categories. So it was this big colorful wall. You'd look at the wall and it looked almost like just post-it notes. And then when you got closer, it was all the different lies in chronological order and then also color-coded by category. And then there's another part of the story, which they will get to, where it got into twice as big. So eventually they wound up with a 20-foot wide by 100 foot wide by 10 foot wide high wall. Oh my God. I got really anxious there and screwed that up. So anyway, that's the deal. But here's the thing. Here's the Dr. Lisa part. Okay. And then I'm going to, and then I really will.
I was going to ask if you wanted to talk about that anxiety that you had about.
No, I do. I'm really anxious. I've got my two authority figures on my two male. These guys make me nervous. So anyway, so here's the deal. Thomas, I have worked on projects with both of them. I mean, I live with Phil. I married Phil. I had a wedding with Phil. So I know, but I can't work with Phil because when I work with Phil, he does not get stuff done on a schedule and it drives me crazy. I just can't work like that. I have to have a deadline. Things have to happen on a, you know, on time and all that. Now, Tom.
That sounds very judgy, doctor.
I am very. I'm your wife, remember? Now, Tom, you know, I've worked with for the last 5 years. He's the director of the radio station, but he's like more in a position where he's an expert, and I'm good at the radio show, but all the stuff that Tom knows how to do the show. He's also great on the radio, but all his expertise, he's an expert in an area that I am not comfortable with. So although I am much better than we ever thought, right, Tom?
Oh, yeah, you're great.
Oh, okay. Wow, I'm going to write that down. So anyway, so here's the thing.
In your diary?
No, in my third-party endorsement project. Oh. Never mind. So anyway, but the thing is, like, I can't imagine the two of them working together because they both, I'm just going to say this, they both have guy egos, all right? You know what I mean, guys? Do you?
Sure. Yeah.
Phil won't admit it, though. Phil, you have a guy ego.
Yeah, a little bit.
But I have to, I mean, I know what you mean, but I know as many women with guy egos as I do men. So I wouldn't put that all on males.
But I'm really sexist and I'm making a really sexist comment. So
fair enough.
So anyway, but you can see what I'm saying. So and Tom, they both are really bossy. Like Tom gets really mad if you fuck up or he's capable. He can get scary or used to get scary when you fuck up. And Phil, I just can't argue with him anymore. I get sick of arguing with him anymore. Like when I'm working on my own projects now, I don't even talk to him about it because I don't want to hear what his opinion is until it's at a certain point. So part of what I'm really interested in, part of what I... What
that's just 20 years of being together, Lisa.
No, but part of what I personally found fascinating is how these two, I have never seen either of them collaborate as well as they did with each other. And I'm not kidding. And also the project they did, I have never in my life I've been a firsthand witness to a lot of assorted projects, believe you me, creative projects, but I have never seen anything blow up so quickly as this project. So it was this huge resounding success. It's not over yet. It still has some some future in it, which we can get to. But anyway, how the fuck did you guys get along? Like, how did they do it? How did they get along? I mean, I want to find that out, but I want to turn it over to you guys. So why don't you just fill in what I didn't fill in about the project so that make sure that the basics of what you guys did is covered, okay?
I mean, I think you covered it pretty well. You know, it was just something that started out as a radio project, and then, I never crossed my mind to do it as a visual project because I'm not a visual artist, and that's not where my mind goes automatically. So, and that's where, you know, Phil came in, and we just sort of, you know, we kind of put the, you know, the ideas together, and
Bones was a good idea. How do you bring to mind and then dramatize 20-something thousand lies? I guess the core of the original idea was to take that database and then dramatize it or make it real for people by how long it would take to read them. In other words, the temporal, how long things take. And it just would take, I don't know how many days, Tom, but a week for the host to read all of them. That same idea, if you just take it into visual space, becomes how much space would those lies take up? And so it's kind of the same idea, just executed in two different media and two different ways to dramatize that to people. So it was it just, from when you did it and then shut it down when COVID hit, it just kind of was sitting there. It was like one of those ideas that was too good to go away, and it was just marinating in my head. That
What was so interesting about it is that what Tom had envisioned was an audio way of processing, comprehending the lies, and the vastness and the amount of them and the specificity. And Phil made it a visual, and then you could kind of see it all at the same time. And it was I think either way it would have been overwhelming, but this was really interesting because we were all able to experience it together, right? You guys were there. The whole project was out in the open, you know, was public. And it was kind of cool how it worked out, right?
Yeah, I mean, it became much more of a community thing. I mean, listening is almost by definition a solitary act,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, unless you're going to a concert or something like that. But you're tuning into the radio. There's something very personal and very intimate about radio listening. And the visual aspect turns it into something else completely. Like you said, it turns it into something that we can all kind of look at and talk to each other about, you know, in real time while we're there. And the other thing that I really liked about it being visual was that you didn't have to come to us to get it, right? Like, it sort of came to you.
Mm-hmm.
It was something that you couldn't, I mean, the second wall is 100 feet wide by 10 feet high, and you couldn't really ignore it when you were walking by. I mean, it was, you know, the kind of thing that sort of overwhelms you and kind of pulls you in,
mm-hmm.
Even if it's just to go, you know, what's that?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the response is that feeling of being overwhelmed. Whereas if it's done on the radio, you can turn it off. It's sort of the expected response is, Jesus Christ, shut the hell up.
right.
This for a week.
Right. That's interesting. And
then, throw your iPhone across the room.
I hadn't thought of that. I hadn't thought of that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So this project really took on a life of its own, which is fascinating, I think. And I thought maybe you guys could tell us the story about where you first put it up and then what happened and how it got moved.
Sure.
And we also want to include like all the mass attention it got. So I think maybe if you want to talk about that too, maybe talk about that first so people can understand how epic it was.
Or, well, I think it's that's all one story.
Yeah, I guess. You know. Yeah, it kind of is. It went from epic to more epic. You're right. I agree. So go ahead.
And I look at it like the waves of exposure. We originally intended it just to be a pop-up thing on a weekend. So like 2 days. And to make an event out of it, we were going to, you know, Tom mm-hmm. had the idea to have a live radio broadcast on Sunday.
Mm-hmm. And then, by the way, folks, this is at 12 Grattan Street in Bushwick by the Morgan L. And it was in conjunction with Pine Box Rock Shop, which is a very popular local bar that happened to have an empty, you know, gate wall next to it. So there you go. All right, go ahead.
Yeah, so it was. You know, once we had the idea of this big 50 by 10 foot wall, where to put it, and the perfect place seemed to be a Pine Box because there was that empty fence next door. And then Heather Rush, who one of the owners of Pine Box, basically she's always done a voter registration drive. So I asked her to do a voter registration drive. So she got involved for that weekend. And then Tom had the idea to do a live radio broadcast. And so we were going to have this kind of, you know, party on the street for 2 days in front of the wall. And that was kind of the extent of where I thought it would go. I kind of knew, you know, we both knew it was going to be very, it's a photogenic thing. I mean, the background of that is almost made for an Instagram world.
Okay, so I'm going to interrupt because I'm keeping this moving.
All right.
And I get annoyed when Phil talks too long. It's my chance to talk over him.
Say, you interrupt Phil a lot more than you do me, but that's because you're married to him, I'm sure.
No, it's just that it was a very exciting launch. The thing looked amazing. Phil, I mean, let's give Phil full credit for putting that whole thing together as far as like the text and the, you know, the imagery. And Tom set up this really amazing, tell us about what it was like when you had the launch. Talk about that.
I mean, the
Phil, launch... I'm sorry, Phil, are you mad at me? I'm looking at him.
No,
he looks mad
I don't
at
know
me.
Who you're talking to now.
Okay, yeah, Tom. Yeah. Okay, Tom, go ahead.
Is the direct question to me? If it's not to me, I will.
Okay, go ahead. Do it, Tom.
Okay. I mean, I, you know, the launch was just, you know, as Phil said, we just wanted to have, you know, kind of a big party and, you know, do a live broadcast and sort of, you know, let people come and experience. And certainly Phil and I wanted to see how the wall was experienced by other people. So we created this event. A lot of people came. Chuck Schumer came to see it unexpectedly, and I got to interview him on the air. So that was really super exciting. But yeah, I mean, we thought after that first weekend, that was basically going to be it. We were going to leave it up until the election or just until the election was decided. And then, you know, it got vandalized and then the story, you know, sort of continued from there. But I mean, you know, we got a fair amount of press for it, even mm-hmm. just for, you know, the initial launch.
Right.
And I think it was because
I'm interrupting you. There's too much to talk about and not enough time. Phil, why don't you tell us about the vandalism since we live like two blocks away from the bar and tell us about that.
Sure. Yeah. The wall took on several, it's like waves of attention, waves in the story. So the first wave was putting it up and having everybody come by and the voter registration, and then Chuck Schumer came. And that was another wave of attention. And then that was on Sunday. Then Wednesday, my studio actually overlooks that wall. So it's very convenient for me to go out there. And you and I were with Astro getting our morning coffee and rounded the corner on my way to my studio and then saw that the wall had been defaced. Mm-hmm. And then as it got closer and closer, you saw that it wasn't just like typical tagging that goes on out here in Bushwick. It was... It's kind of like hate speech. It was vote Trump or die, and then stand back and stand by, and the whole wall was covered. So that was like a body blow. And then I sent some photos. We wouldn't have even seen it for a while, but I sent photos to Tom, who then passed them on to Radio Free Brooklyn. And then Tom got this fundraiser going to replace the wall. That I think we had enough money in a couple of hours to do that. But it was,
That's amazing.
So bummed out. But the reaction of the Radio Free Brooklyn group, like Tom and Rachel and Rob and everybody and Sal, were just like jumped back into gear. I mean, they were Sal was sending out press releases again about the defacement that got it even more attention and took it to a whole nother level. So it was it was like a waves. We rode the first wave, and then this was the second wave of.
Tom, what was your reaction? Because you heard about it, and then like to get all that love from posting about it and how people responded.
Yeah, it was. I mean, that was great. To be very honest, I was worried from the beginning, and Phil will tell you this. I was even after we put it up. I'm like, what if it gets graffitied before the opening party? And he was like, no, it won't get graffitied. And still, I would like. And I remember Phil texted me the day after we put it up, and which was like the day before the party, and he just wrote like no tags, because I was like I was stressed about it, and it did remain intact until
a Schumer press
for the
came
party.
Out.
Yeah. I mean, and it remained intact for the for the party, and then it wasn't until the middle of the next week that it got. That it got vandalized, and then Phil texted me, and I was like, oh, "Fuck, I knew it," you know. But I didn't, I didn't realize right away that it was this hate speech that it had vandalized it, and then it was just like fury.
Now, how much? I mean, you guys tell us. I want to hear a little bit about the press and the amount of tension and the kind of response you got, because you tell us like how much response you got just from the. Wall originally, and then the added response, media response when it got vandalized. You got more press, right?
Even more than the first time, yeah.
Yeah, the first time was local press. It was like, who was it? It was like Radio Bushwick Daily did something, and then News 12 Brooklyn did a
BK
little.
BK Reader, yeah.
Yeah, BK Reader. And I think that's what brought Schumer was. One of those locally, because he was happened to be, Congress wasn't in session, so he was in Brooklyn where he lives. And then after the it was defaced, then like the next day, there were stories in the Daily News or that was it the next day or that day? It was that day. So it got defaced on a Wednesday night. Thursday, there were stories in the Daily News and the New York Post and a bunch of others about the defacement.
I'm going to throw in my two cents here, too, because I was there when Chuck Schumer showed up. And it was so weird because this old guy with a mask on ambles out of like some big black car. And I'm like, why is somebody's dad's here? And then he starts, who's in charge here? And I'm like, why is this old guy? Who does he think he is? Yeah. And then how did they who recognized it was Chuck Schumer? Do you remember?
I don't know. I just remember I was talking to Tom on the radio about it, and then this old guy with, a mask on is like, yeah, who's in charge here? And then I'm like, oh, my God, it's one of those people. And then he comes in even closer. Who's in charge here? And then somebody else, that's Chuck Schumer, and we both were like.
Okay.
And then Tom kicked me out of my chair.
Neither of you recognized him. That's great. So, okay, so you – get all this press, the thing gets vandalized, that's very disappointing. But then there's this huge, like really surprising silver lining, right? Who would have ever expected that it would get vandalized? And then all the, donations and love pouring out from that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I would characterize it as silver lining exactly. just because, like, I mean, I was kind of happy for it to be sort of, over and to be up until the election. And
right.
That's great and everything. We did the project and it was successful.
Lemons to lemonade. How's that? Is
okay,
that it?
That's better.
Lemons
that's,
to lemonade, I think,
yeah,
is
that's,
better.
That's,
right.
That's
okay.
That's
yeah.
That's definitely.
Okay. That
better.
Works for us.
Well, it definitely changed how the community saw it, too. I mean, they liked it as a public artwork on that Saturday and Sunday, but then it became They got really defensive about it. Kind of, they owned it at that point because they couldn't believe somebody, would write Proud Boy graffiti. I mean, this is like a bastion of Bernie Sanders supporters, and out here in Bushwick. And for you to imagine that somebody would write "Vote Trump or Die" and then stand back and stand by on this thing, people really took it personally. And then there was kind of this, I don't know, community ownership of the wall, which then translated to me, and I think to Tom, as it went from a project we put up to a responsibility we had now to this,
Oh, that's
what this
interesting.
became.
Yeah, I also want to add, in case people can't picture this, it's right next to the local bar. And so every time you go past there, every time, somebody goes, there were a constant stream of people outside looking at it and commenting on it. And then if Phil or Tom was there, we'd say, "Oh, here's the artists." And then they would get all, be surrounded by people asking questions. But it became very much a living thing because it was out in public, 24/7, and people would hear about it and come by. And you could go there anytime and talk to people who were looking at it. And unlike most projects, you just got a ton of immediate feedback. Isn't that right, guys?
Yeah,
Yeah.
much different than like having a gallery show where you go to the opening and then it's silence after that and you wait to see if you get a review. Here it was, anytime I wanted, my studio, like I said, looks out on it. So anytime if I looked out the window and I saw a crowd out there, I could walk downstairs and then talk to people.
So did
And
you, did you notice a difference in the reaction from when you first put it up till when it was vandalized? Did you notice like how people were behaving around it?
oh, for sure. I mean, it became much, well, they became much more, "What are you going to do?" And I would put no,
What are
right.
you
"What are
gonna
you going to
do?
do about this vandalism?" We had to put a note up. So we kept people posted. So I would post little, I'd post up a bunch of notes like, "Oh, it got vandalized, but we're raising money to put it up somewhere else, and fix it." So people, keeping them posted, because they would go into the bar or wherever and ask questions about it, or the say coffee next door. So we wanted to, so people were coming out special to see it. And then somebody, what changed it also, where the community owned it, was, we didn't mention this yet, but the on top of where it said "Vote Trump or Die," somebody cut out, right out of the vinyl mural, cut out Trump's name. And then spray painted behind it on the fence, hearts, and then in this pink color. And then on over "Stand Back and Stand By," they basically covered that over, and then spray painted "Love Thy Neighbor."
Which
So it was
is,
kind of the community response to this vandalism.
yeah, it had a whole dialogue in the neighborhood. It's so awesome. And also, I just want to remind you guys, if you're listening, well, you are listening if I'm talking to you, but go to Wall of Lies on radiofreebrooklyn.org. There's a whole, there's a whole repository of all the photos and press and stuff like that. So you should go check that out so you can see exactly what we're talking about.
Wait,
So
what did you say? I wasn't listening.
I was Okay, that's it, Tom. You're off. No, I just told people to go look it up on radiofreebrooklyn.org/wallof lies. Tom, you were next anyway. I want you to tell everybody. I want to hear what happened, how when you got donations to repair it, how did it get to the next phase, the phase in Soho? How did you get?
Well, right. So we got roughly $4,000
Incredible.
in
Crazy.
donations, and so that allowed us to build, twice a wall of twice the size, which we got on immediately, and then I also hired a security guard for
Well.
to look after it for the 2 nights between, when we put it up and when we were going to have the sort of second opening party in Soho. And then Phil had located this, this fence down the corner of Grand and Lafayette, and it went up very soon. I think we put it up about a, I think it was a week, the next week. We
Yeah.
went right? The next Thursday we went and put it up.
So what was that like when you guys got that up and you saw, like, it was twice, it was already huge. And then when it was up, it was twice as big. I mean, what was that like when you saw it? Was it just like, oh my God?
It seemed more than twice as big to me. Like adding just another 50 feet to it made it seem like, I mean, the impact, I feel like, sort of increased exponentially.
It went from
than just, you know, twice, you know.
Well, it's also went from a side street in Brooklyn where, you know, there's basically one lane of traffic between parked cars to, you know, a major Manhattan Avenue where, you know, that's probably seven lanes of traffic wide. And you weren't allowed to park in front of it. So basically it took up visual space in Manhattan, which is hard to do. So it was big. I mean, and it was one part we left out was originally we didn't know if we were going to replace the wall in Brooklyn and just put another 50-foot wall up. But then we talked to people out in front of the wall and say, what should we do? Should we put a new wall up? And because the old wall that was defaced and then reclaimed with the hearts, people wanted to leave that up as kind of a part of this dialogue about what Trump's lies have done to the country. So, and then people basically said, yeah, put it up someplace else. And that actually, to take it from Brooklyn, which kind of was now owned by the Brooklyn community, to bring it into Soho, which also had, I mean, Brooklyn's full of street art, and Soho was kind of where a lot of that started way back. So it was in a community of artists, because we put it on a fence that was originally called the Soho Oasis fence, where people put Black Lives Matter art on it. So we were actually putting it back, putting it onto a place, onto a big fence that had a history of people putting protest art.
So as far as the reaction, so you have two very different neighborhoods, right? You have a small, out of the way, but near the Morgan L wall. And then you have basically, it was really just about a city block on Lafayette Street in the middle of Soho. What was the difference in the response that you got both, you know, both places? Were this different, or what was different about it, or what did you notice?
One thing I noticed is that there were more, even though it got more bad, you know, the vandalism was worse in Bushwick, there were more Trump supporters, it seemed.
Wow.
That were seeing the wall in Manhattan. And even when we were putting it up, I mean, we had a Trump supporter come by and call us, you know, commie pigs, and you know,
what do you say? You're going to go from Radio Free Brooklyn to
Radio Commie. Yeah.
How did you react to that? I mean, you didn't get any of that in Bushwick, right?
No, I mean, the way that I think that you always react to that is you just sort of, you know, engage in calm, polite conversation and not a shouting match, which is what they're looking for.
Right.
And then they sort of, you know, they just sort of go away on their own.
Well, when you just point to the wall and say there's nothing on this wall that Trump actually didn't say.
Yeah.
It's really hard to argue with it. You could, you know, it's... Yeah, right. He said, I mean, these 20,000 things.
And I think that's one of the great things about the wall, too, is that it's not, you know, the only commentary, it's the only thing that we're doing really is reflecting Trump's own words back to him. You know, we're sort of just holding a mirror up to it and saying, you know, we're stringing together all of these things that he said that just all happened to be not true. And the only real sort of political commentary that we added to the wall was the name, right? The wall of lies,
which
is also just a fact, because these have been fact checked. So.
Right.
It's a little bit. The Post, Washington Post, where we got all the lies. What are the euphemism they use? exaggerate. What are they? They have like it's 20,000.
Oh, false or misleading statements.
False or misleading statements, and we just outright call them lies, which some of the press started calling
wall
them.
Of false or misleading.
Wall of false
statements doesn't have the same ring.
Right.
They really soft pedal that, and you also kept in touch with your connection at the Wall Street Journal, right? The Washington Post. That's what I meant. So you.
Oh, he tweeted out about a lot of the other thing we didn't talk about. We got press, but Rex Chapman, who was an XNBA player, he had 1 million followers. He tweeted out. His tweets got like 20,000 retweets.
Rosie O'Donnell,
Chuck Schumer,
Judd Apatow.
Yeah, Glenn Kessler from who was the fact checker. He retweeted it, and then Washington Post people retweeted it. So it kind of, and especially since it's even in Instagram, it's so visual that it will stop you when you are flipping through your stuff to find out what that is. It spread. We couldn't keep track of where it went. It just kind of went out in the wild, and it probably had millions and millions of impressions, but we had no idea.
So were you completely must have been taken by surprise. Did you not expect to get this kind of reaction, or what was that like?
I mean, I've had public art things even in the same street that this was, where I put something out there. I actually did a 360 walk-in photograph of a Trump rally, as well as the Women's March on Washington a different year. And you might get one or two articles, and nothing, it's kind of like, people notice it. This exploded way beyond.
But what about the impact, the feeling of impact? You must have felt like you were really, did it have a feeling of connection and impact and relevance almost bigger than the project?
I was going to say relevance. I mean, it definitely had a feeling of relevance. I've been producing stuff for ages, and you never know what's going to blow up and what isn't. But it usually is the things that are relevant. I produced a show called the Wrong Fag to Fuck With.
I love
the gay pimp versus Eminem, and this is when there was all the controversy about sort of Eminem and stuff he was saying about gay people. And that blew up, right? So that had lines around the block to see.
Oh,
that.
Wow.
And it was this little, sort of, as ragtag groups of comedians and actors and artists doing this midnight show at Surf Reality on the Lower East Side.
Wait, I got to say one thing about that, though. It had sex and celebrities. This did not. The Wild Lies. You know what I'm saying? It's a much harder sell.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what's Phil laughing about? I don't know.
I'm just thinking about, we could have taken it to another level with some sex and celebrities.
Oh, yeah. Right. Well, they were in there. They were mentioned. There was a lot of sex in those
lives.
Well,
honestly, there are so many lives about so many different kinds of people. I mean, you could make custom walls of lies that are like lies just about gay people, lies black people.
Well, the one difference between the wall in Brooklyn and the one in Manhattan is because we were on this... with their support, the people that had the Soho Oasis, this is one thing I learned about with Tom is he's very community, focused, doesn't want to step on anybody's toes. So it was like a negotiation or not a negotiation, but had to contact the person who kind of was the spirit behind the Soho Oasis. And she wanted all the artists whose work we might move to be contacted and get their permission. And so it really, you learn that it is a community. And then once you get the community behind you, boy, you can really go even further than if it's one person, if it was me or if it was me and Tom, and then me, Tom, and Radio Free Brooklyn, and me, Tom, Radio Free Brooklyn and Bushwick, and then Soho. So part of it was, and I think the press and all of the social media picked up on that it wasn't us. It was the wall.
Yeah.
And what I loved was when I love reading the commentary on other people's posts on Instagram that you're totally disconnected from. Your name's not on it. It might say Wall of Lies. And then you read the love and the hate. And people in New York were really... in Bushwick and in Manhattan, that this was the people from New York were like, this was a New York thing. This is what we did. Us New Yorkers did about Trump right before the election. So they took ownership of it and pride in it.
And, if I can circle that back to what you were asking at the beginning about, collaboration, I think that that's one of the reasons that this worked so well is that I don't feel like there was a lot of ego in it for Phil or for me, you know? I mean, because it wasn't about our work as artists. It was about the work, period. You know, it was about the thing that we were creating.
Yeah, and I can attest to, I mean, the radio station is based on a very community. I mean, Tom, it was your vision, but it's very community oriented. And I love how many people and the radio station have this how Radio Free Brooklyn embraced it as their project too. And it really did feel like it was a community, you know, and then the people at Pine Box, Heather and Jeff, they were involved and really people did feel ownership of it. And that is a really, that's a beautiful thing. You don't see that a lot with anybody's creative projects that, the idea and the beauty of it is so big that other people feel attached to it, and it was really. I love that.
In Soho, it became like a barn raising because when we got there, people brought rope, and the one in Soho was torn down. The whole thing was torn down. We had to put it back up, and somebody brought a ladder, like a 10-foot ladder, and another person brought rope to help put it back up. It was, like I said, like a barn raising. We had as much help as we wanted, we could get.
Yeah. No, it's and so anyway, now what I want to do is I want to hear a little bit about what your next, what the next phase of it. I know it still has some life in it and what's going to happen with it. And then I want to make sure we have enough time where I can grill you two if you think you're as annoying with each other as I think you both are, if that made any sense. But go ahead. So what's next? What's next for the Wall of Lies?
I guess it's, we're in conversations with a major New York institution museum about donating it to their collection because they have a collection on New York history and political speech. So hopefully Tom and I could pass off, let somebody else adopt it. So it's kind of, it's like I said, we now feel like it's a responsibility. So it's actually rolled up in my studio right now. So,
But it has a historical significance now. I believe that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been torn. It's got battle scars. It has battle scars. Yeah. And then that's the immediate thing is to find a home for it. And then the second thing is we've already made plans to bring it down.
We're all going to Washington, right, Tom?
Yep.
Yeah, we're going to go. We're going to bring the wall down to Washington, and I guess we're going to lay it out on the mall, the National Mall, on the day before the inauguration. And then, you know, beyond that, I mean, yeah, I think it's great that somebody is going to sort of, you know, adopt it and, you know, maybe it will, you know, be displayed again somewhere, and which would be great. But, yeah, I mean, I think that,
Maybe we'll make it bigger because we'll have to see if Glenn Kessler has the lies since the wall.
Yeah, but I mean, I feel like there's a certain amount of relevance that's going to disappear after you know Biden becomes president. But then in 20 years, when people are looking back on what the hell were we thinking?
You know? How did that happen?
Right. Then it might become really valuable again, you know, to be able to see something like that.
Which brings me back to the collaboration aspect, because as I was saying, I think I was very impressed and proud of both of you in a way, how well you got along and how you both really committed to it and brought so much to it. It really became so much bigger than the whole, two parts bigger than the whole. And, you know, I think that you, between, you know, what you were able to create and the community involved, then you found a way to harness a lot of energy that I can imagine could happen on another project in the future.
We've talked about, we don't know what it is yet, but we've talked about doing something that's kind of public and involves visual art and involves sound. Like that was what's nice about why we didn't argue so much, because we come from two totally different places that are somehow connected.
Ah, you had your own things.
Right. That, I mean, I really think that that's true. That's one of the things I was going to say too, is that we each have our own sort of different, I mean, not aesthetics, but are just sort of way of doing things and different, skill sets. And I think that putting them together, I mean, there were times that, there were ideas that I didn't like as so much, but I was, but when you think about the end project, which you have to do, you sort of say to yourself, this is not a hill I want to die on. I want to see the, I want to see this thing happen. And for the most part, I mean, I thought working with Phil was very, very easy, to be honest with you.
Really?
Yeah.
God. So what about, this is what I can't imagine. Did he get, like, did you have trouble with timing or anything like that? Were you like waiting around for stuff from him or anything like that?
The only thing that I really worried about was that things wouldn't get done in time, like the printing wouldn't get done in time.
Right.
But I just like I mean I was really stressed about that because
Right,
Phil was like,
right.
oh, don't worry, if we get it there by noon tomorrow, it'll be done by Thursday morning. And I'm like hyperventilating.
Right.
But then you just have to trust that, like, okay, Phil's done this kind of thing before, visual art projects, and he's worked with this vendor before. He knows what they can do and what they can't do, and just have to sort of trust that. And one of the nice things about last minute projects is that you just kind of have to get them done quickly, and there's not really any time for quibbling or for worrying, that you just have to ship, right? You just have to get it out the door.
Well, that's true. I mean, one of Phil's strengths is he is really good working under pressure and under a tight deadline and stuff like that. So, I mean, he was also like just really passionate about the project and really focused completely on it. So Phil was like Tom, did Tom ever like say like tell you that you were doing things wrong? Did he ever lose his temper? Tom, did Tom ever lose his temper, Phil? That's what I want to know, really. Did he? Or he's on good meds now, I think maybe not. Maybe it's the meds. So
Aren't we all?
did he lose his temper? No.
No. He got, when it got tagged and the or torn down. Yeah. I think Tom, I'm like, oh, whoever it was is lucky they're not around. 'Cause, but then again, I'm like, Tom's even taller than I am. So I said, oh, we could take care of whoever. But it was, yeah, it's nice to work on a physical project with somebody who's big and can carry
Yeah, I
things.
mean, guys, we're talking about like two people, in the 200 plus range, 5'3" and over,
Five
okay?
three.
Five three.
Well, you're, I mean, six three.
Six.
Phil's 6'3". Phil's a big guy and Tom's even a bit bigger. So, yeah. So, no fucking around. There was nothing.
You know what was fun too is outside of the wall, when you're working with somebody on a project and you're like, okay, let's talk about this idea. Oh, let's go have a beer and lunch. And then we could talk about it and we could talk about other things at that time. And then it would kind of just that, we became better friends during that whole process. So then that makes it so much easier because, you don't want to get your way. You want to have it, the other person, it work out for them too. And they get what, their vision comes true. So it was kind of a nice, way to cement a friendship.
Yeah.
Tom, did Phil talk shit about me at all?
No, we didn't talk about you at all, actually.
He didn't
So,
talk about me at all.
not, oh, yeah. I mean, only good
Oh,
things.
he's like
That's what I
waiting.
meant.
He's like, oh,
I
that's
couldn't shut him up about
bullshit.
how great you were, but he
Oh,
didn't
shut
say anything
up.
about.
Shut up. No.
We did talk turn a little bit when we were putting the wall up at first. There were these construction guys from Verizon ripping the sidewalk up in front of where we were going to put the wall and pouring new concrete down. And they're typical construction guys. So you start getting into the rhythm of it when, some pretty girl walks by and they're like, "Hey, the models are here." you kind of just laugh with those guys because, you know, that's who you were with at the moment. But it was just fun to kind
of. So you got to check out a lot of chicks. So are the chicks, the chicks are better looking in Bushwick. I want to believe that. What do you think? No, not necessarily. Depends. What do you think?
It's a totally different fashion sensibility in Bushwick versus Soho.
Yeah, those chicks are really polished, right?
I'd say there's a lot more money in Soho than there is in Bushwick.
Yeah, better deal.
Well, it's also on the border of between Soho. We're right next to Chinatown, right below Nolita. So it was a mixed neighborhood.
It was a total mix of people. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why I was saying we could tell there were Trump people driving by or whatever, because that's a major outlet back out to, you know, you're going to go over get out and go to Staten Island or go over to Bay Ridge. That's the road you take to get to one of those bridges.
This project had some global influence. I mean, did you meet, first of all, you were interviewed, I know, by a lot of different media outlets from all over the world, like Japan and stuff like that, Germany.
Germany, South Africa.
CNN Espanol.
Yeah.
And you had media posted everywhere, right? All over?
Yeah, I mean, we've had, in those countries and in Russian TV actually put something up on YouTube, Russian state TV.
The timing was perfect because if we had done it in this, you know, it was just that the election was in the last, was going to be, we put it up at the beginning of October. So we had 1 month and then the second wall went up 2 weeks later. So it was, I think media was hungry for another story, but one that they could put their own wrap around it. Mm-hmm. So it kind of landed right at the right time for a lot of media, especially the interest outside. And we it was funny, later it came to us that the wall, if you were from like CNN and Espanol, you know, it was an allusion to the border wall with Mexico. So there was a whole nother connotation that originally we were looking at as here's a wall we put up, you know, as a public art piece, but then it became another wall.
I'm still getting emails and messages from people who are like, you know, I'm sorry I missed it. Are you going to be putting it up again? Mm. I get phone calls.
Really?
I get messages from the GoFundMe page.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. A lot of people are really, you know, they come down to see it and then they're bummed that it's gone.
Wow. So,
I'm looking forward to, there's a fifth grade, teachers reached out to us from a fifth grade class in Massachusetts. So we're going to be doing like a conversation with this group of fifth graders
on Zoom.
Yeah.
Are you gonna record that? You've got to. Please do. You've got to post it on the Wall of Lies page. So did you learn about how other people saw, you know, our government or anything like that? Did you get a different perspective than one that you had, or Were you made aware of different perspective that different people had that would come and talk to you?
No, it's what you'd expect. There's two kinds of people. We mostly, probably 90% of the people we saw, met, or saw on social were, you know, definitely going to vote for Biden, and the other 10% were, you know, and so you'd see that reaction just like you would on social media.
I see more of it. There's not a lot of middle grounds right now, in terms of where you stand.
Yeah.
So it's one side or the other.
Do you think people from other parts of the world understand what, like, they really get it? What we get?
100%.
Hmm. I think the Germans and the Japanese in particular.
And the Italian press actually did a lot of stuff on this wall.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you had a history of democracy now, but had a history of fascism, like Japan, Germany, Italy, I think that was particularly, I think they particularly wanted to shine a light on that.
Agreed.
I mean, our biggest allies, and yet, you know, they've lost faith in the U.S. a bit.
Tom, It was so annoying. You know what the worst thing was? Phil wouldn't shut up about the wall lies for a month. Like, that's all he talked about. Come on, you got to give me, you can imagine, you got to give me some sympathy. Can you imagine what I went through?
Sure. I mean, you know, I don't know what to say about that. I live alone. I guess my cat probably heard a lot about the wall of lies as well.
Were you taught it? Were you as was it like, did it really consumed all of Phil's every waking moment?
Yeah, well,
Did it feel like that for you?
Phil also had the added job of doing all of the digital stuff.
Right, that's true.
So that's a big difference. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I was pretty much focused 24/7 for those first couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it wouldn't go. It didn't stop. We thought we'd be done.
I know.
But it wasn't the same story. It was a new story every day of what happened that day that was crazy.
Yeah. It was
You haven't heard about it much since.
No, I haven't. Phil, I was pretty good, right? Say I was pretty, I was pretty supportive.
Yes, you were very supportive.
I really tried, guys. It wasn't easy sometimes.
His fingerprints are on there. Whenever I had the fine tuning of like the explanatory text and the color key and all of that, how to make that look. I'm not a graphic designer, so
the long copy. I'm good with long copy is really what happened.
I'd send her some graphics.
I mean, to the point about not being a graphic designer, and neither am I. I think that, I mean, while there were different sort of design treatments that Phil came up with, what we came up with was so very basic that it's like, I mean, people ask me, like, who did the design? I mean, I would say, like, Excel, Microsoft. Because basically it's just a grid, you know? I mean, just a grid with color coding. And that's it. And that's
not that easy to do with.
No, I'm not saying
in
that,
the scale.
That's not my right. Yeah. That's not my point. I mean, my point is that without us going down some super artsy road with it, I mean, I even was sort of, you know, I thought at first that the name was too basic, right? That we should like go with something that was like more like it's naming an art piece rather than the wall of lies. But that turned out to be 100% the way to go with it is to just present, right?
Yeah.
So, like not present our, for lack of a better word, our ego within it. You know, let's just present what it is in as simple a way as we possibly can.
Well, that's what I love about projects like that, because from beginning to end, through and through, it was literally just the facts. And just all the creativity, there's so much of it, but it's invisible to what is seen.
Right.
What, Phil?
No, that's...
I just thought what you were going to say.
We were just going to say that the only brand, thing we signed it off with on the original wall was somewhere in the corner. It kind of gave the color code, and then it gave Instagram handles for me, Tom, and Radio Free Brooklyn, and a credit to the Washington Post.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very, underplayed where it came from.
Mm-hmm. Okay, guys, you know what? I'm going to say thank you because we only have 2 minutes left, and I want to say goodbye to everybody and tell them about our really fabulous new sponsor and everything, the City Running Tours. So thanks, and I am really excited to see what happens with this, and I just want to remind everybody, go to RadioFreeBrooklyn.org and Wall of Lies. There's an entire section that you can see. Also, you should listen to Tom's show, which is on Thursdays. Same lineup in the evening right after mine. Mine's 2 to 3. And Tom, yours is?
Mine's from 8 to 10.
8 to 10, Frequency Theory. And
that's PM.
PM. Yeah. Thank you, Phil. So this was very, very interesting. And I can't wait to see what happens in Washington. So that you're going to be
January 19th.
January 19th. Look for it, guys. In the meantime, I just want to tell you about City Running Tours, which is a great tour. They offer neighborhood running tours. Don't you think that's really awesome? Like you can go and run around the neighborhood as a tour.
It's a very cool idea.
It is. It's a really great idea.
And I've actually heard really good things about that particular tour company.
Really? That is good to know. I mean, I had never thought about anything like this, but if you're into running or you like to run once in a while, even, it just sounds great. There's 23 different tours of neighborhoods in Manhattan and Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx. So we have it. The website is cityrunningtours.com. Okay. Thanks for listening.
All right.
Dr. Lisa gives a shit.